You can probably hear the goats all around me, and I am here with Felipe Morales, who looks after these goats. And we're in a very rural community called Las Blancas. The sun is beating down. It's very dry. There are horses and goats. Felipe, ¿me puedes explicar un poco, bueno, dónde estamos y lo que haces?
Bueno, nosotros aquí nos dedicamos a lo principal, la ganadería caprina y ovina. El tema de nosotros es que llevamos como 8 años emigrando aquí de nuestro hogar en busca de pastoreo para las cabras.
Felipe is just explaining to me that he looks after herds of goats here and sheep, and for the last 8 years or so, because of the mega drought, they've been having real problems finding enough grass and enough food for their animals, so they've had to look elsewhere. Entonces, ¿cómo es aquí en verano?
En el verano es muy seco, no hay agua, los tiene que abastecer camiones de la municipalidad. Toda la gente por aquí tiene que emigrar con su ganado porque la mayoría lo ha perdido, ha muerto por la sequía.
He's explaining to me that especially in summer it's really, really hot here and that they have to get all their water from other places. There's no drinking water here. It all has to be delivered by lorry. And lots of people have had to leave here because of the problems with the mega drought and the dryness, and they have to look for pasture elsewhere.
En los años 90, que fue las últimas veces que...
I can see a bridge in front of me where the cars are crossing, and there's one further down the road. And Lillian's just been saying that back in the 1990s, there was so much water in this now dry river that both bridges were lost because of the water, and people had to walk all the way around to get to school or to get to different parts of town. But now there is no water. Drought is a massive problem for Chile, not just for the residents of Tiltil, a region around an hour's drive from the capital, Santiago, but also for many other parts of the country. I'm Jane Chambers, and I've been living in Chile for more than 10 years. I've seen huge changes in that time. It used to rain frequently in the winter months between June and September, and the Andes Mountains, which run down the whole of Chile, were snow-capped all year round. But that doesn't happen anymore. And it's a cause for celebration on the few days it rains in Santiago. In Discovery, I'm reporting on the impact of the mega drought on the country and what's been done about it. René Garoa, a professor in the Geophysics Department at the University of Chile and deputy director of the Centre for Climate and Resilience Research, has been following the changes in rainfall.
The mega drought, it's a term that we coined a few years ago when we realized that something strange was happening. I clearly remember 2010 was a dry year, but it was what we call, the climatologists, we call La Niña. But then came 2011 and 2012 and 2013, etc. And then we realized, oh, wow, this is a long stretch of dry conditions, an interrupted sequence of years. So we came up with this name, the mega drought or the mega sequía. Central Chile has always experienced droughts and big droughts. But this was something different, not because it was too much intense, but it was too long. And this was only, I remember this when we released a report to the nation that even we handed to the president, Michelle Bachelet, in this moment. So the term was precisely designed to catch the attention of the public and the policymakers, etc. And to our surprise, the mega drought has continued, and we are already living one decade under these deficitary conditions. Just a few days ago, one of my colleagues, he has a daughter that is 10 years old, so she has always lived in this kind of new normal.
For those of you who aren't familiar with South America, Chile is a long, thin country. It goes from the Atacama Desert, with one of the driest climates on Earth, to the ice fields and glaciers of Patagonia. The capital, Santiago, where I live, is in the central area where most of the population live. Francisco Mesa is a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Forestry at the Catholic University in Santiago. He studies the impact of the mega drought.
That's a characteristic of this mega drought that is covering a very large part of the country. I would say that the effects of this drought are felt from 500 kilometers north of Santiago towards 700 kilometers south. It's 1,200 kilometers that you are covering. And this is where the core of the agricultural community is living and generating not only their products but also demanding jobs. So it's a chain of events that can have social consequences as well.
What kind of deficit are we talking about here?
It depends on the year. At the very beginning, you have like 20, 25, 30% less. But this is a thing that keeps repeating over the years. So you start seeing some manifestations like a drop in the aquifers and the reservoirs, and they're not able to recover fastly. Last year was particularly bad in terms of precipitation. And I don't know all the numbers, but around Santiago, you have probably an amount that only happens once or twice in 100 years. So this is the level of the dryness that we have had over this period.
Sebastian Vecuna, director of the Global Change Research Center, paints a picture of the large-scale changes in Chile.
Forest fires and trees is one example. The other one is in the basin, the central to the northern part of the country. You basically see rivers that are dry for many parts of the year, and most of them don't reach out to the ocean because all the water is depleted before it reaches to the ocean. And there's an academic term for that. It's called a closed basin when that happens, when all the water inside the basin is used up to a point where there's no water flowing into the ocean. And there's impacts of in that case when there is no water flowing into the ocean because there's no nutrients feeding ecosystems that require those nutrients, sediments that are also moved along in the river that are needed to form beaches and also help the thrive of the ecosystems there.
Chile is a country of farmers growing all kinds of crops, from corn to vineyards, fruit to cows. Francisco Mesa is monitoring how farmers are adapting to these new drier conditions. Wine's a massive business in Chile, and the growers are changing their methods.
Some of them, they're doing that. They're investing in irrigation. It has some advantages in terms of the ability to control and generate better quality wines by introducing certain shocks and stresses in the vines during the period. But most of it is related to how to better use the water.
Because they have those systems where it's drip
irrigation. They have drip irrigation. They have or other types of pressurized irrigation, not only drip. But they're highly efficient in terms of the amount of water that goes into the root zone. That's all that matters. With a colleague we're working on, and she does fantastic work on new ways to increase the efficiency, like there's a technique called regulated deficit irrigation or partial root drying, and we're trying those things as a way to increase the yields that you can get per drop. Probably you're not going to get the maximum yield, but it's going to be the amount that your water supply systems really allow you, and you're confident doing that.
Goat farming is one of the main sources of income in the Till-Till region. Flocks of black and white goats graze on the arid hills. Their milk is used to make cheese, which is sold in little makeshift stalls along the roads and exported to other parts of Chile. But there's a problem for farmers like Felipe. The mega drought means there isn't enough pasture for their herds, and they need to think of other ways to feed them.
La estabulación del ganado, que ya no sea tanto pastoreo natural en pradera.
Felipe is explaining to me that one way they can adapt is by giving their livestock, their goats, different things to eat and not having them roaming free on their pasture. But obviously the problem with this is the costs. It's much more expensive to not allow them to graze around here and to just have them all kind of indoors with a different kind of food. So what's causing the mega drought? Central Chile has always had years with low rainfall. So is this just natural variation? René explains how climate scientists look back to understand the present.
You can look at what we call the tree rings. That are excellent proxies that tell us something about the environmental conditions in the past, particularly precipitation, because these trees are very sensitive, particularly the one here in near Santiago or in central Chile. They respond primarily to precipitation. This allows us to have a record that's, instead of having 100 years long, it's probably 1,000 years long.
a group of colleagues, they just finished creating what they call the South American Drought Atlas. It's not only for central Chile, but a large portion of South America. And we see a lot of variability. We see some centuries that have been particularly wet, other centuries that have been particularly dry. We find in this particular case for central Chile, we found that this mega drought, this period of 10 years, it's very unusual. In general, the drying trend during the 20th century and this particular mega drought now in this last decade start to look like something that is beyond the range of natural variability.
So you've spoken to me about what's going on. Let's now discuss why it's going on.
Perfect.
Is this because of climate change?
We found that there is, like almost every, in every situation, it's a multifactorial thing, right? Every year over the oceans, the temperatures are different. And that's having a strong effect in atmospheric circulation. And this is what we call the natural variability. The ocean's current, they're very variable, etc. And they happen to be in this kind of a phase that's produce or foster this strong anticyclone that's inhibit the arrival of frontal system to central Chile. We can do experiments in our computers. According to our results, this is more or less two-thirds of the signal is still due to natural causes. But there is another, and we have the hope that this natural cause at some moment will disappear or even reverse sign. But you have about one-third of this mega drought that is caused by a new kid on the block. And this new actor is precisely climate change. Climate change is changing everything. When people talk about climate change, they immediately think, oh, the world is warming, and that's true. But also, you have these changes in circulation. It's bad for us because normally, actually, when you look at these projections, and now I am starting to move into the future, most of the world, we get more precipitation. When you make a balance of the whole planet, in a warmer world, you will have more precipitation in average. But there is a few regions, which are precisely these subtropical Mediterranean regions, like the west coast of North America, part of Europe, South Africa, part of Australia, and central Chile. These are these Mediterranean semi-arid climates. And they will experience, all of them have an anticyclone close by. These anticyclones will get stronger, and that will inhibit precipitation. So unfortunately, I always use this analogy that's the future. This is not the future yet, but this is how the future will be. Will be warm and dry for us. Probably in this, and when I mean the future, I mean the rest of the 21st century. And probably we will, at some moment, we will have a few years that will be back to normal in terms of precipitation. Some, maybe we even can surpass the average. But in the long term, unfortunately, what we are seeing here, it's what will happen. Still, we have this name, mega drought, but at some moment, this will be kind of the normal condition for central Chile.
Those of us who live in Chile will have to get used to drought. In Santiago, I always have water in the taps. It's the people outside the cities who are particularly suffering. They often have to rely on water brought to their homes in trucks. This distribution problem is down to the complex way water rights have been awarded in the past. Sebastian Vicuña explains some of the consequences of the system.
One is this idea that the water rights is given for perpetuity and without an initial cost. So there was a large amount of water rights granted at the beginning of this system that didn't have a use at that time and now are held by a small number of people, and that's called hoarding of those water rights without a cost. Except there were some reforms like 10, 15 years ago about a penalty of hoarding too much water and not using it. So the perpetuity of it, it's one criticism. The other one is the fact that there is no priority officially in terms of the assignment and the reassignment of water. You have the same priority if you are a industry asking for water or if you are a drinking water provider. There's no priority in those water rights. And that's different from, for example, the case in Australia or in California, where there is priority for certain types of water use. Also, the price and who is transacting this water is not a clear and process or an open process. So there's another criticism about how the market is working on this reassignment of water. And finally, although there have been some improvements, there is no clear position for the environment on this process, because obviously the environment doesn't participate naturally on this market-driven system, and typically it will be the environment that will suffer the consequences of reassignment of water to the highest value in terms of water use.
As the mega drought continues, people are finding new ways of capturing water. Desalination is one approach. Pablo Casola is the founder and CEO of Remote Waters. His company is providing small-scale equipment that can deliver clean drinkable water from the ocean. And it's a good option because many Chileans choose to live on or near the 6,000 kilometers of coastline.
The technology that we use is called reverse osmosis. Sometimes we use nanofiltration or ultrafiltration. It depends on the water quality. We always do water analysis. Then we use the best technology.
And for those who don't know, what is reverse osmosis?
Water comes through a filtering tube. It can come, in our case, it comes from outside the tube. And only inside the tube, H2O particles will come inside. So we will only let pure water come inside the tube. And the outer side of the tube, there will be a more concentrated salty water than the source. So in that case, what we do is that we reuse those salty water and go through the next filter. And then we do it again. And by doing so, we are increasing our recovery rate so that at the end of the process, when you use 100 liters coming in, you will get 50 liters of pure water coming out, and another 50 liters of brine water, I would say, coming out, that will go back to the source to be diluted in a huge source like the sea, for example.
Now, obviously it's good because Chile's a long, skinny country with a lot of coastline, so there's a lot of salty water about. But some people also talk about the costs involved, that this requires a lot of energy. Is it cost effective?
You're absolutely right. The two biggest cost in the desalination, I would say, are energy, the energy intensity that you use, and the second one will be the maintenance area. So in terms of energy, we're reaching about 2 kilowatts per hour per cubic meter. That's very low. And we can use solar energy to avoid those energy costs. And for maintenance cost, what we're using is automation and remote control. So we can do most of the maintenance remotely, and that's why we can lower the operating price. And even for a small scale desalination systems, we're reaching about a dollar per cubic meter if you take into account the investment and 10 years of generation.
Now, a lot of people say that these systems are very sophisticated and sometimes difficult to use, or if parts get broken. So is it user-friendly? Is it something that people in local communities can use?
That's a great question too, and I get it a lot from the people that want to use it. I mean, will I learn how to use it? Is it complicated to use? The truth is that once we explain it, people tend to understand it very well, and there's more complicated maintenance and there's basic maintenance. So let's say you have to fix a pump. That would be complicated, right? But you don't need to fix it every week or every month, right? It takes some years. So that's why we are there, or we use a local distributor, right? But for the most simple maintenance, they can do it. It's just changing a filter that is dirty and change it for another one. It's pretty cheap. It's like $10 each filter. You can find it locally anywhere, and so that's easy. Of course, we leave also videos and manuals, I guess, for them. And in any case, we are just a phone, and sometimes we use even IP cameras so that they can show us what they're doing, and at real time we can guide them through the maintenance.
And in the school of a tiny little village called Montenegro, Tomas Marin is piloting another experimental technology. The aim is to capture water from the air. Tomas is the managing director of ProTilTil, an organization made up of local companies that invest in and promote social projects in the region. We are standing in a completely empty classroom because at the moment children are doing classes online. But in the corner of the room, there is a brown box with a copper-looking tube coming out of the top, which looks a bit like a tap, and inside lots of machinery. And this is part of an initiative that Tomas is doing with a company called Freshwater, and it's one of the ways they're adapting to the mega drought here in the region of Tiltil. Can you explain what's in front of us? ¿Puede explicar qué está enfrente de nosotros, por favor?
Bueno, este es un dispositivo que genera agua a partir de la humedad atmosférica.
So Thomas is explaining to me that this machine, or whatever you might call it, this machine in front of us has been donated to the school. We're actually in the school dining room, and it makes water from the air, and it's very, very useful because this is a village, this is a place where they don't have any running water and they rely on trucks to bring them their water. How does it work? I mean, it sounds amazing that a machine can make water out of air. So how on earth does that work? ¿Cómo funciona?
Sí. La máquina lo que hace básicamente es condensar la humedad del aire en una nube que la genera de manera artificial.
He's explaining it's a bit like the air conditioning machines where you see at the back that there are drops of water dripping out. This will condense the water in the air and turn it into drinking water and filter it and be able to produce liters of water every day, which can help the local community. And why is it so important for you to have this machine in the school? ¿Por qué es tan importante para ustedes tener esa máquina aquí en un colegio?
Sí. Nosotros estamos buscando soluciones público-privadas para que pueda llegar agua de manera permanente a la comuna.
Tomás is explaining that they work with private and public sectors and they're always looking for innovative ways to adapt to this way of living with a mega drought. And this is actually a pilot scheme, and this local school has 40 students and they are seeing if it works, and if it does work, then they will roll it out to other schools in the region. It's very important, isn't it, that people in this region who are living with a mega drought learn to live with the little resources that they have, with the little water that they have. So I would imagine one of the ways of doing that is getting the next generation to understand about water. Why is it so important for you to have this here in a school?
Claro, decidimos partir en una escuela porque además de instalar el dispositivo, esto nos da la posibilidad de hablar con los niños respecto de la importancia del agua.
Tomás is explaining to me that it's very important to have it in a school because through the children, they can teach the rest of the community, their parents and their relations, about the importance of looking after water as a very scarce commodity, and that they've got a number of workshops where they will be teaching the children about this new machine here and also about the importance of water and what you can do to conserve it. Obviously, because of coronavirus, the children aren't here in school at the moment, but that is something that will happen in the future. But are the people of Chile prepared to make the changes that are needed to ensure that the scarce water gets to those who really need it? Sebastian Vecuna, director of the Global Change Research Centre.
We don't have in Chile, for example, and that's something different from both the Australian and the California case, there's no restrictions on how water is used, even under the worst droughts. So it's all up to the citizens to really reduce their water consumption. There is no formal restrictions, for example, not using water for irrigating lawns or watering the front of the house or washing cars, which is something that occurs in other places. Those would be the first type of water uses that are banned in a bad drought. And here in Chile, we don't have that power from the authority. So it's all up to the citizens to really reduce water consumption.
It's evident that in rural areas, the drought is having a real impact. But as I traveled to the University of Chile to meet René, I was struck by the number of swimming pools and people watering their lawns to keep them green. He says those in the city will have to change their behaviour too.
We like green. But in fact, I think that at some moment, I think that I saw this sign in California. It said, brown is the new green. right? Making the point that at some moment we will have to look the natural vegetation. This is the natural. It's not green in central Chile. It can be green for a few months, but we will have to adapt to this. There is obviously a lot of consumption in the domestic side, but probably the main consumer is, again, agriculture and industry in general. So the citizens have to do their part, but also we have to look for the big numbers, and the big numbers is essentially agriculture here in Chile.
All the scientists I spoke to are convinced that industries and the farming community need to adapt to Chile's new climate. And for me, it's clear that the whole country has to learn different ways to cope with the mega drought. If, like Felipe, the goat farmer in Tiltil, they want their current lifestyle to continue.
Que la generación de la crianza de ganado de nosotros ya viene como a ser la quinta aquí porque mi abuelita de que nació y tiene más de 100 años.
Felipe is explaining to me that he's the fifth generation of goat farmers here. It's been around 100 years that they've been here, and he really hopes his children can carry on with this tradition because it's something that he loves and he wants them to be able to do. ¿Y piensa que hay futuro para ellos?
Yo creo que sí. Haciendo las cosas bien y llevando un plan de manejo en el ganado como corresponde, pienso que sí.
Good. Qué bueno. He says yes, he does think that there's a future for them as long as they learn to manage their resources and adapt to what's going on with climate change. I'm Jane Chambers, and that was Discovery from the BBC. The producer was Deborah Cohen.
Hi, I'm Catty Kay.
And I'm Carlos Watson.
I'm a British journalist in America.
And I'm an American journalist in America.
As a presenter for BBC World News, who's based in Washington, D.C., I spend my life surrounded by the people who make American politics happen, or perhaps not happen. People who make decisions that affect ordinary folk around the country and the rest of the world.
And as a presenter of my own talk show, I spend my time meeting the game changers and change makers from across politics, entrepreneurship, entertainment, activism, and sports, because only by listening to new perspectives do I think we can actually figure out a way forward.
So we thought we should get together at this crucial moment in American history to talk about where the country is coming from, and perhaps even more important, where it's going to.
I'm so excited about digging in on the most important issues that are facing the country today, some of which may be obvious, but some which may be a little more subtle.
So what we've come up with is When Catty Met Carlos, a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
And Aussie Media. Just search When Catty Met Carlos wherever you get your podcasts and smile.